Welcome to another episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thanks so much for downloading and listening or watching, however you may be consuming this podcast. We appreciate you checking us out. This is the last full episode of the year 2025, and it's heading to the holidays, but I want to make sure that as people travel or spending time around family, just want to go for a walk and get away from it all, you have a chance to learn about sports and digital and social, sports business, all that good stuff. And let me tell you, this episode today will deliver. I was so psyched to be able to get this guest on. My guest on the podcast today is Lewis Wiltshire. He's a Senior Vice President and Managing Director of Digital at IMG, the biggest and most prestigious sports marketing agency in the world. Lewis is full of good information and insight. He has such an impressive background. Has truly been in this space for decades. Has seen everything you can see. Has so much knowledge and can really bring a lot of that knowledge from all of his colleagues at IMG as well, who have boots on the ground all around the world, helping sports rights holders and properties do so much innovation and monetization and fan development and fan engagement. And we have a great conversation about digital strategy, about social and sports, about where the space is going, about AI, about creating fans in China and other countries abroad. Just so much good stuff here. So here he is, listen up to my conversation with Lewis Wiltshire of IMG. I am back on the podcast with today's guest. I'm so excited to be speaking with him. As I've mentioned to him and following his work, whether it's with Seven League or with IMG, my guest on the podcast today is Lewis Wiltshire. He is the Senior Vice President and Managing Director for Digital at IMG. And welcome to the podcast today, Lewis.
Thanks a lot, Neil. Really excited to be here, and looking forward to the conversation. Thank you.
Hell yeah, you guys do so much good work there, IMG, and you have been in the space for several years, not to date you too much, but you've seen a lot, you've done a lot, you've experienced a lot, and there's a lot I'm going to be able to learn from you today.
Yeah, my career started before the internet, in effect. I mean, I guess the internet existed, but not in any meaningful way for mainstream usage. And at the start of my career in the mid-90s, it certainly wasn't a factor, but within really a few years of my career, it became obvious that this was going to be the direction my career went in. So yeah, I'm celebrating 30 years. So I don't mind you dating me at all, Neil. I'm proud of it. My first job in the sports industry was in the summer of 1995. So 30 years this year.
There we go. So give us a quick, before we get into the meat of our discussion, give us a quick overview of your career path, starting out in broadcast journalism, working your way into digital. Just give us our viewers and listeners an idea of where you come from and what you're doing today, of course.
Yep, started my career in local newspapers here in the UK. Like a lot of kids who grow up sports mad, I wanted to be a footballer, and if I couldn't be a footballer, the next best thing was writing about it. So my background, the start that I had was actually as a young sort of junior sports reporter. After a couple of different newspapers that I worked for, in 2001 was when digital really took over my career, and my career has been at the intersection of sports and digital ever since. So I went to the BBC in 2001. It was then the nascent BBC Sport website. It had only begun in 2000 as a sort of a separate website from BBC News at that time. And I joined the BBC Sport website in 2001. Ended up staying for 11 years. Ended up being editor of the BBC Sport website, BBC Sport's first social media editor, kind of like establishing BBC Sport on social media in that really exhilarating period of Web 2 when, you had Facebook 2004, YouTube 2005, Twitter 2006, the first iPhone in 2007. And we moved into that era of defined by social media and smartphones and apps. And it just, for me, it changed the world. From the BBC, I was in a role right at the end of my BBC career where I was overseeing our preparations for the London 2012 Olympics across BBC Sport's digital portfolio. And then Twitter wanted me to go across initially to oversee the Olympics for them as well. But it was the role I moved into was Twitter's first UK head of sport, Twitter's first sports hire outside the US. Stayed at Twitter for 5 years, eventually became senior director of media for a bunch of markets for Twitter globally, as well as global sports lead at Twitter, and then joined, as you say, Seven League. And Seven League at that time, when I joined in 2017, was an independent digital agency. We became part of the Mailman Group in 2018, which is China's leading digital sports agency. And then in 2020, I was asked to be the CEO of Seven League. And in 2021, we were acquired by IMG. So In 2023, we retired gracefully and with love and respect. We retired the name Seven League. And in 2025, most excitingly, what we've done this year is we've brought three formerly separate digital agencies within our business together to form one digital division, which is the business that I previously led, which was the old Seven League business, which by this point was the IMG digital team. Plus, of course, what was the Mailman business based out of Asia, Asia's leading digital sports agency, and our FC Diaz business, or the digital part of the FC Diaz business, which is in South America. So those three formerly separate digital teams came together in 2025 as part of IMG, which is part of TKO. And that is now the division I lead, which is more than 200 digital experts on five continents, serving some of the biggest sports rights holders in the world, and thrilled to do so.
That's why I'm so excited to have you on here, because you just have such a broad overview of what this world looks like. And oftentimes it's easy to get stuck in our silos, especially in the States, where we think, you know, the world revolves around us, the sun revolves around the US, of course. But to understand like how fans are engaging in China, how fans are engaging in South America, what the business models look like, what the monetization models look like. It's endlessly fascinating to me. If people are just you know, tuning in, they have to realize that the majority of the population lives in China and India. And so if you can reach those people, and then the growing population in Africa, like it's a very big world, and you get to see a you know a good view into it of how sports are evolving across the world, and as sports becomes more global in nature as well. It's so fascinating. But I want to bounce back a little bit in of how you kind of you have grown into your roots as a digital leader, and I think about my own experience of coming in early and with you at the BBC. Like early on, I imagine you know it was all about driving tune in to the broadcast, and then eventually you had a website, and it was like, and then we use social to drive traffic to the website, and then social, we finally realized, hey, social in itself can be something very valuable. It doesn't have to be just a clickbait and get back to a website. Like I remember early in my career, it was, you know, don't share the video on Twitter or on Facebook. Share the link back to your website because we got those video starts. So how did you start to understand like what were the success metrics and models and KPIs? Like what was the purpose of these digital platforms as they evolved, and how did that sort of you know change as your career went on?
Yeah, no, it's a your recollections are spot on that there was a huge amount of that kind of dynamic in the industry. At the BBC sport website, I would say when we first started it, it was mostly a sports news service, I would say. It was headlines and news stories more than it was about driving to broadcast necessarily, and certainly more than it felt live, because I think at that stage we hadn't even really begun to do even live text commentaries on websites. That even that came a short while after that, and websites started to feel a bit more dynamic. Remember, at that point when I first went to the BBC Sport in 2001, you know, there were no apps, there was no social media. It was a one-to-many, fairly sort of one-dimensional. Not just the BBC, but every sports news website was the same. It was sort of headlines and breaking news, and didn't feel particularly live. Certainly didn't feel very interactive or positive, you know.
Yeah, there was no second screen yet. That was not a concept at
There
that
was no concept of second screening, unless you wanted to drag a tower PC into your
point.
living room while you watched the game. You know, I mean, you know, most people were consuming web sports news websites in that era in offices, frankly. Like, there was probably more people who had access to the internet in offices and during work hours than at home. So it was just a very different landscape. But the thing that hit me, like, you know, just an it just a the most impactful and profound revelation I think I've ever experienced in my career was that Web 2 moment. I mean, we start like all revolutions, it started quietly and small, and then just grew and grew and grew like a steady drumbeat. You know, you started to hear about this website called Facebook, which somehow only university students could access. And you know, by that point, we were running sort of live text commentaries on the BBC Sport website, and finding that we were getting interaction from Facebook, or that people were talking about our work on Facebook. And it was like, what's Facebook? And it was something to do with colleges and universities. And you know, it started to grow from there. And of course, say Facebook 04, YouTube 05, Twitter was created in 06. And Twitter, I think, as well as the fact that it changed my career because I went to work there, I think it fundamentally changed the notion of what live meant on the internet, right? Like, it was a live news service, really, where anyone could post and anyone could use it, and you were following stories in real time. It sped everything up. It gave everyone a voice. Yeah, all of those platforms have gone in different directions since, but for me, it was just an unbelievably exciting time. Instagram came a bit later, Snapchat came a bit later, TikTok. But for a while there, where you had like Facebook, Twitter, and to an extent, Instagram, it was just the most exciting period. And where I was at the time, BBC Sport, we absolutely used those platforms to reach more people.
And when you think about it, whether it was from your time at Twitter or even or now with IMG, like how do these social platforms in particular, and digital, I know digital is much bigger than social, of course, fit into the business models? I mean, the majority of revenue still comes from the media rights deals, and that's been the case for several years and has not quite changed yet. We haven't quite monetized, as much as I consume, NBA highlights on Twitter or whatever. It's not monetized in the same way as if I was watching a live game on NBC or on Amazon. So, like, how has that value prop sort of shifted over the years? And I mean, are we going to be able to monetize the fan through digital social means as much as we can monetize the fan if they're watching, not necessarily linear rights, but live rights and sponsorships and subscriptions? Like, what does that value prop look like? What did it look like originally of why you should be on Twitter, why you should put some highlights on here, why you should put your live broadcast on here at times, and how does it look like, what does it look like today even?
Yeah, no, I think since that era, and we're talking 20 years now, right? Since the advent of Web 2, you could argue that everything has changed, and at the same time, nothing at all has changed. I mean, the arguments for putting your sport out there as a rights holder are not that different from what they were 20 years ago, which is that fundamentally, sports rights holders, sports organizations, just need more people to like their sport. They need more people to
Yeah.
be interested.
Mark
And to become
marketing, fan
fans.
development in that sense.
Right. To a very large extent, it was and remains top of the funnel, one to many broad top of the funnel marketing. And yeah, look, I would say that's absolutely the case still. But I think where it's evolved, to your point, is there are just more, there are many more ways that you can reach digital audiences now than then. There are many more platforms. There are many more ways to do it. We don't live in that world now of just Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But more importantly, to your point, Neil, I think that point you made still holds true, which is that overwhelmingly the revenues in the sports industry will continue to come from rights, commercial sponsorship deals, and to an extent, ticket sales, and digital will be a huge part of that, and needs to have ROI. It needs to wash its own face in terms of the revenue it generates. Digital should be a revenue generator, not a cost center.
Yeah.
But it's not it's it wouldn't have the same revenues that rights and commercial have, and that's fine, because it actually, and this plays back to why I'm so excited to run a digital division within IMG, the world's first, best, and most iconic sports marketing company, is that we've got every element of that landscape to support rights holders in. We can support them across rights deal media rights representation. We can support them on commercial sponsorship deals. We can certainly support them on digital, and we can ensure that digital becomes has an ROI to it, but it will take
Yeah.
its place in that arsenal.
So if we think about the, because I mean, there's a point where, and I think you see this sometimes in studies of like ad spend and ad marketing dollars of, okay, the attention is here, the ad spend is still here, and it's like, when are we going to catch up to where the eyeballs are and where the engagement's happening? And that's kind of playing out in sports now, where a lot more fans are being exposed to sport through, whether it's highlights or even just attention and headlines and whatnot, through those, again, less monetized areas like digital platforms. So do you think of like the digital only fan as still certainly a valuable fan, but it's less about like, what does that funnel look like now? How do we monetize a digital only fan the same way we do a fan who's going to, engage with us on these live platforms and drive those bigger audiences that are driving these billion-dollar deals? I mean, think about some of the digital first leagues now, like Kings League and Ballers League, of course, are the ones that always people always mention that, kind of askew those big linear rights deals and say we're going to do it digital first and we're going to do it through creators. So like is the digital only fan something that we are still trying to monetize to the highest degree, as opposed to thinking about digital as being top of funnel and getting them to convert to some other higher lifetime value fan?
Well, I think one of the things that we do at IMG is to sensibly and strategically work with rights holders to work out what their individual strategy should be, right? Like we definitely don't apply, not that you were implying that anyone would, Neil, but we wouldn't ever apply a cookie cutter approach to a strategy, right? So in
Right.
some cases, digital activity, in order to be a top of funnel marketing acquisition tool to bring people into your sport and make more people like the sport is absolutely still the way to go. But we will also drill down into more sophisticated marketing techniques, especially when a rights holder might want to use digital as a means of driving revenue directly, or at least, as I mentioned earlier, to sort of wash its own face and be a profit center rather than a cost center. I think it's worth saying, because of as what everything we just discussed, that the sports industry main revenues have come from and continue to come from media rights deals, sponsorship, commercial partnerships, etc. It means that sport is behind other sectors in terms of being fully digital. Like sport ultimately is not, it is not, as much as we might all feel like we're part of the digital ecosystem within the sports industry, and therefore the sports industry feels to us very digital. The reality is that the sports industry is not a digital only business, right? Like that we are, the sports industry is ultimately live events that happen in stadiums, and we are providing a digital arm which services that in terms of marketing, audience reach, audience engagement, monetization. But all businesses that are truly digital first, that are just simply e-com businesses or businesses where digital is 100% of their customer acquisition and engagement are ahead. They're ahead of sports in terms of knowing this person on your website is also this person that you're reaching out to via paid media, or is also the same person that you're reaching out to via a CRM email campaign, or the person that you're reaching on push notifications, and actually which one of those things would they react to the best. We're getting there with sports, and there's people on my team, really smart people, that are drilling into this now with sports rights holders. But I'd say the sports industry is behind, because it's not where the value is, not where most of the value is created. It's where some of the value is created.
Yeah, no, I love this. It's an interesting like way to think about the sort of, because it's, as social and digital is becoming a lot more niche and a lot more like segmented, and like there are communities on TikTok that I don't even know they exist, but they're huge, but they won't reach me because it's not part of my interest graph, for example. Whereas like sport, and you could say is in theory and in its utopian vision is one of the last remaining potentially monocultural things. Like we're all watching the Super Bowl. We're all seeing the same ads on Super Bowl as well, and that's by design. They're broadcasting too. It's not personalized to me. It's being shown to 150 million people around the world. Those same popular ads, or at least 100 million people in the U.S. at least. So as you start to think about this increased fragmentation of culture and community, what does that mean for how sports think about content on social, as well as how sponsors should be activating within sport on social? Is it not so much about like we're trying to reach all the fans of Arsenal? I'm an Arsenal fan. All the fans of Arsenal, but we're trying to reach the fans on Arsenal who are part of this cohort. So we're going to serve them this content versus this cohort. We're going to serve them this content. Like, how do you start to think about this increased fragmentation? Or is it still that sport can bring people together and we can still, get messaging to them and then monetize them through partnerships that way with messages that just reach a broader audience? Like, how do you think that sort of broadcasting versus narrowcasting when it comes to monetizing and engaging a fan base?
Well, firstly, let me say, as a Spurs fan, you and I are still getting along pretty well. And we discussed, before you started recording, we discussed the San Francisco Giants and the San Diego Padres. You're wearing your Padres hat, so I've not worn a Giants hat here. But we're getting along famously, despite and listen, that That is community, right? That is sports community. We
There we
all live in
go.
one big ecosystem. No, look, I think there's a couple of points that are interesting there, Neil. One is around there is a really fascinating point there around community, and there is a really fascinating point as well about the sort of the changing nature of social media platforms. I mean, let's talk about the community bit anyway. That the world doesn't always feel right now like a cohesive place where everybody is getting along wonderfully and we're all great friends. Like, I think we can probably agree that, and I don't think that's controversial. I would argue that sports is a unifier. I mean, and I'm going to get to the community bit, but you talk about we all watch the Super Bowl, right? And absolutely 100% agree. Like, we all watch the Super Bowl, and just thinking about that for a moment, that is a shared human global experience that we are all taking part in together, and therefore that is the global community. That's the Spurs fans and the Arsenal fans. We all watch the Super Bowl, and there is that is a beautiful thing that only sports can do. There is a live nature to that. There is a community aspect to that, and potentially some of the biggest award shows and music
World Cup,
festivals
of course, too, of course, and all that.
will have that. But primarily, I would argue that it is sports which fundamentally brings human beings together in a cohesive way and builds shared aspirations, ambitions, and IMG, we talk about that we power the passion for sport, and that is a really important thing to me. That I fundamentally believe that, a 10-year-old kid doesn't grow up wanting to work for a sports marketing agency. A 10-year-old kid grows up wanting to play for the San Diego Padres, Tottenham Hotspur, whatever it might be. Therefore, we as a sports marketing agency should always put the sports to the front of the stage. I fundamentally believe that in my very soul, that the stars of the show are the sports, not the sports marketing agency. And that's why at IMG, our vision, our mission to power the passion for sports really resonates with me, because that's how I see our role, is to power these sports from underneath, to push them forward, to help them to reach more people. And that's a really key point about something like the Super Bowl. But the point I wanted to make about community around something like this use the Super Bowl as an example, is that whilst it's true that we're all watching the same thing and there's a beauty to that, it's also true that is happening in hundreds of thousands or millions and hundreds of millions of different communities, which all add up to the same Super Bowl community. There will be a community talking about the Super Bowl in French and looking at the NFL France social media channels, for example. But there will be communities talking about that on WhatsApp channels, or WhatsApp groups, I should say, as well as WhatsApp channels. There will be people talking about that on various messaging apps, on various social media.
And having different conversations too. Like, some people might be
And
watching
having
for the
different
halftime show. Some
conversations.
people are watching for the commercials
Right.
and the pop culture and the celebrity sightings. Some people are watching for the X's and O's and what's happening in the game. And
Right.
so, yes, we're all watching the same thing, but we may have different things that are attracting us to it.
100%. And you put it brilliantly. And that is where an organization like the IMG digital team, within such a powerful and respected sports marketing a business like IMG, can really hit on behalf of a rights holder, because we always say translation does not equal localization.
Right.
Localization, true localization, is not just taking mothership content and translating it into the local dialect or language. It's truly having boots on the ground. And at this point in technological advancement, we're still talking about human boots on the ground. Like, AI is coming, but it can't do this bit yet. Is having true boots on the ground, which understand local culture, local memes, local internet memes, like sometimes really obscure
Right.
Reddit memes or whatever it might be that take place in that market. And we understand those because we have people in those markets running social media channels and communities, which is the important word, for some of the biggest sports rights holders in the world. So it's a big part of what we do, and something I'm really, really proud of, because I fundamentally believe in that global community, which plays out through hundreds of millions of local communities.
And so, is that like a feature, not a bug necessarily, where It's yes, you might have an OpenAI or a Tesla or whoever who's trying to reach every single person watching that game, and they might do it in different ways, like with a with whether it's different languages or different memes, to your point, or different pop culture references, as opposed to saying like, well, this brand, they're trying to reach this specific audience. This, whether it's a, they're trying to reach vegetarians, they're trying to reach Chinese people, they're trying to reach Africans, whatever it might be. Like, is it are we going to a future where there's going to be different? Again, different monetization structures to put it more eloquently, or different ads to put it more like straight up, different sponsors activating, as opposed to these more monolithic ways that we've engaged and ultimately monetized sports fans in the past.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I mean, and look, AI will play a big part in that, right? I mean, at the moment, when you do paid advertising campaigns on social media platforms, you're going to spend as much time correcting the AI as using the AI. But it'll get there, right? I mean, it will get there, and that will create that sense of highly personalized, to me, advertising around a shared event experience. So. Look, it's the way that the industry's been going. I always say that what we gained in Web 2 versus Web 1 was two things, which was personalization and participation. For the first time, I could take part in the internet, and I could also tailor the internet to what it was that I wanted to consume. Obviously, with the third era of the internet, I won't say Web 3 because that means different things to different people and NFTs and all that. I'm talking about the third era of the internet, which is clearly and demonstrably different from Web 2 in as much as it's going to be built around AI, but also AR and VR and to a certain extent, maybe even some of those Web 3 technologies, blockchain in some way, form, or shape or other. We'll come back through that for sports at least. That I think we will increase that even more, and that personalization will be mind-blowing compared to what we had 20 years earlier. It's not quite there yet, but it's definitely getting there.
How are you guys advising properties to think about these global fan bases that have a lot in common because they all cheer for the same team, but also don't have a lot in common because they're from different cultures, different like so when you're thinking about when you're talking to like, I'm just gonna use Spurs, I don't know if they're a client or not, but because you mentioned Tottenham, like is it this is how we advise you to engage your fan base, or this is how we advise you to engage your fan base in Korea, and this, then it's different from how we're going to engage your fan base in Europe, and different from the US, and different ways we're going to monetize them, or at least different partners we're going to bring into them. Or like, is it, are you guys looking at that fan base as a whole, or are you looking at that fan base as a cohort of related but ultimately uniquely different segments?
They are different. Communities are different and have to be interacted with in quite unique ways by people that who understand those markets and those communities within those markets. Because it absolutely is not the case that just because the US, let's say soccer audience, and I'm talking generally here, not about any specific clients, but just because we might agree that the US soccer audience is different from the soccer audience in Australia or Singapore or Africa or the Middle East, that doesn't mean that all of the soccer communities in the US are the same as each other. Clearly not. So I think it needs the old art of community management is still alive here, right? This is an art form that is as old as the internet itself, which requires people to have a true understanding of the communities that they are interacting with, guiding, steering, but also oftentimes listening and learning and responding to. It's a beautiful thing and an art form in itself, and I think it's really important. And yeah, to answer your question, Neil, it is something that me and my team at the IMG Digital team spend a lot of time doing, which is just helping sports rights holders globally to unlock audiences in very specific places using boots on the ground expertise that we have there.
Yeah, because I mean, to your point, like I could follow an Arsenal account, and that's their OG account because it's in English, so it doesn't matter about the language. But I could also follow an Arsenal like US focused account that's more attuned to US references and maybe has a different appeal to potential sponsors who are looking to reach an American audience that are football fans. So there's
100%.
different ways to slice and dice there, I imagine.
Yeah, 100%. I think you nailed it. I mean, we live in a world now where AI will enable a sports rights holder to translate into any language in the world instantly, right? Like, you could put one of your athletes up for interview, and the athlete, he or she might be being interviewed and speaking in English, and that could go out in real time in any language in the world. And that you know, to an extent, that's fine, and is interesting technology, and will absolutely have its place, of course. But you know, the athlete might not want that, and might not feel that they're able to express themselves in that way, in a way of their choosing. So it needs to be handled delicately. It's also true when we did our IMG Digital Trends report recently, which I know you saw. One of our trends was more, which is this idea that for many years, the sort of universally accepted truth for digital native social media people like us was that less is more. You know, that you don't flood the channels, that you that engagement is everything, and you post fewer and bigger and better, and you get more engagement, and you et cetera. We've all heard that through the course of our careers. Of course, no one's suggesting that you flood the channels with bad content, but what we are saying is that more, as one of our trends in the IMG report refers to the fact that the platforms are craving more. The platforms are telling you, as a publisher, publish more. This is the way to succeed. This is the way to get more reach. This is the way you'll get more engagement. Ultimately, this is the way that you'll get more monetization. And when the platforms are telling you that that's the way that you win on their platforms, you do have to respond to that. When AI is going to create a world for us, has already created a world for us where we can create an almost infinite number of content assets to publish on every platform in the world in real time using any language in the world. That's going to create some interesting dynamics. One of which is going to be the language issue is going to go away. But at the same time, what that doesn't give you, really importantly, is true localization. It's just language, right? It doesn't mean that you're localizing for real-time communities on the ground in those markets. The other thing that I think is interesting about that is I think it could well lead to a slightly reduced expectation of standards of accuracy for some content. And that, for our industry, is a fascinating dynamic, right? Because again, we've grown up with an era where if you get something wrong, that's a problem. And we're also now in an era where we use agentic AI tools, and we accept up to a point, a certain level of margin of error, right? They hallucinate, they're not quite right. They don't always land exactly. What happens when we take our slightly reduced expectations of accuracy from agentic AI and apply that to hundreds of thousands of content assets published by a rights holder, let's say, in every language in the world, simultaneously to every platform in the world? Does that mean that some of our fan base will have a slightly reduced expectation of accuracy? And if so, what does that mean for volume of publishing versus the standards that we would generally have always held ourselves to? I'm not saying it's right or wrong. We're just heading down a path with some quite interesting dilemmas still to come and play out.
Yeah, it's a super interesting insight to think about how we can scale to the nth degree, and sometimes it would not necessarily have everything have some human oversight necessarily.
Right.
I want to touch it. You mentioned the digital trends report, which I thought was great, and I think everyone watching and listening to this should check out the IMG digital trends report for 2026. And one thing that caught my eye, among other things, that I wanted to pick your brain on, Lewis, and just a couple more minutes left here with Lewis Wilshire, Senior Vice President and Managing Director of Digital for IMG. We'll get to the shareable stat in just a moment here. Was the place of short form video in the fan development funnel? I think we are all very seduced in a good way that the short form videos can get massive viewership. It can help us reach people that may not like some of those popular videos on YouTube Shorts or TikTok. A lot of the viewers may not even know it came from a sports team. It's just they show you how they prepare the field with the landscapers before a game, and it's the most fascinating thing you've ever seen. But you don't care if it was from a Premier League team or a Championship team or a Division II team, whatever it might be. And so like, who are these people that short form video is reaching? How should we think about the success and where they fit into the fan funnel? Is it a fan development platform? Is it a top of funnel? And how do we move those fans into actually being fans and not just viewers? Like, where does short form fit for sports clubs, and how you guys think about it at IMG?
Yeah, look, I mean, we challenged in one of our trends in the IMG Trends report, we have challenged the notion that seems to have taken a hold that if you want to reach young audiences, Gen Z, et cetera, that first of all, it has to be short form, it has to be vertical. And secondly, that it absolutely cannot be long form in any way, shape, or form. We would argue that The phenomenal success of Netflix, the phenomenal success of YouTube, of podcasting like this one, the phenomenal success of gaming and gaming platforms, and streaming platforms around gaming, all of which disprove this theory that Gen Z doesn't like long form
Oh.
content. Our argument is that Gen Z doesn't dislike long form content. Gen Z dislikes boring content,
Right.
and the notion that that you have to be short form and vertical to catch young people's attention is so obviously and demonstrably wrong, that it's clearly being used as an excuse by publishers who are publishing bad long form content and wondering why no one wants to watch it. So we've pushed back on that in the trends report, but it's also true that short form vertical has an enormous role, right? I mean, like let's be clear on that. We're not suggesting that
Right.
that it doesn't. We're suggesting that short form, and we've touched on top of the funnel marketing a few times in this conversation, Neil, and we think in the IMG Digital team that short form vertical is that. It's potentially sort of one to many, going back to that kind of almost one to many broadcasting, but in a way that is obviously short form and bite size and hopefully well produced, and broadly should hit, right? Because the algorithms on platforms like TikTok now are so good,
Right.
that as one of the people on my team says, with TikTok, you either love the content or you don't see the content. Like
Gotcha.
there is no don't like the content.
Right.
And so by definition, the short form vertical content will land and should attract because of the way it's because of the way that the platforms treat that they and prioritize that content. It's going to be seen by people outside of your immediate fan base, outside of your immediate community. So by definition, it can act as a really impactful and powerful top of funnel marketing tool. We just think that there is also a place for really well produced long form,
Yeah.
and that's what comes back to my more point, because more platforms demanding more content from you, good content, well produced content, not just AI slop, but well produced human content at scale, and we're all of us just being asked to do more of that, and unfortunately, fortunately or unfortunately, the reality is that's just how you win.
What is the like what does that funnel look like? If you think about some short form content being top of funnel, we got a bunch of fans, or not fans, but users who really enjoyed seeing how we stitch players' names on the back of our jersey after a transfer. Or whatever, just a random like non-sport related content. If that's top of funnel, what does the bottom of the funnel look like? Like, where do we want to get those casual fans who, again, who may not even know it's a football club that's producing this content? Like, where do we want to take them? How do we take them there? Or is that not the right question to be asking?
No, I think it's absolutely the question to be asking. It's one of the many questions that rights holders need to be asking in order to have a relationship with their fans globally. And that means having a global strategy because you can't do everything, right? Like, having a global strategy doesn't mean we're going to be on every single platform. It doesn't mean we're going to publish the maximum volume of content on every single platform. It doesn't mean that we're going to try every short form idea, every long form expensively produced idea, and we're going to do that on every platform all of the time. And then we're going to drive people through this funnel, and then we're going to know all of these people, hundreds and hundreds of millions, if not billions of people, and we're going to have a relationship with them where we know their preferences,
Right.
and can sell to them accordingly. Like, obviously not. But what it does mean is that we can move people through that funnel, and we can get to a point, which I touched on earlier, where which other sectors are honestly ahead of sports in this area, because they've had to be, because they are truly digital only businesses, that do have that sense of like they know that this person who interacts with us here is the same person that's interacting with us over
Right.
here, but their preferences is for push or email or whatever it might be. And we kind of know that in terms of them spending money with our business, that we know when in that process that's likely to happen, and we can sort of help them along that path. All of that, I think, will continue for sports. We're not quite there yet. We're doing a lot of top of funnel, but as an industry, then we can, working with organizations like ours, rights holders can move further down that path.
Yeah. Oh, this is great. One last thing for the Turbo Stat, Lewis, and I feel like there's no one better to ask this question, and something I ask people in the digital space all the time, and especially working with global brands in sport, what does monetizing that non-local fan look like? I mean, for years it was, we're gonna sell tickets and gate, and it's all about getting fans to ultimately become season ticket holders, and that's the pinnacle of fandom. And now, especially I think during the pandemic, we all have this big revelation of, how do we monetize fans more effectively who are never going to come to our games, locally? Maybe it's a one-time bucket list thing. There's, digital memberships. There's obviously sponsorships and partner sponsor activation. Maybe there's sort of fan subscriptions. There's off-season tours and events on site there. Like, what are you seeing of how do you monetize that digital, not so that, I guess, that digital only fan, or even that fan who it's not even feasible to ever get them to come to a game more than once in their lives?
Yeah, and I would argue that, and you referred to it in an earlier part of this conversation, Neil. I would argue that driving fans to broadcast is absolutely a part of that mix. Everything you just said, plus that, plus also a few other things as well, like attractiveness to commercial partners by demonstrating a large engaged audience in markets and sectors that your potential commercial partners are interested in reaching, right? Live audiences, which we know sports delivers to a far greater extent and than almost any other content vertical in the world. But take out the word almost, than any other content vertical in the world. Live audiences at scale. Look, I mean, sports rights holders can generate revenue from a global fan base in any number of ways, but it needs a plan. And it absolutely, to your point, won't always be. In fact, in the vast majority of cases, will not be a fan buying tickets to the stadium. Just because of the global nature of sports fandom, there are people who will never come to the stadium. And you better have a plan for those people. And that could be, as I say, taking evidence of your large and engaged fan base in market to a broadcaster or a commercial partner, or any of the other ways that you explain there, Neil, in terms of having a direct relationship with a fan and direct monetization.
I love it. It's very thought-provoking stuff, and it's endlessly fascinating and fun to get creative and think about it as well. But we're going to have some fun with Lewis after our shareable stat in our stoppage time segment. But here's Sepp's shareable stat coming up right now. Right back from this episode of Shareable Stat, and I'm joined once again by Lewis Wilcher. He is the Senior Vice President and Managing Director for Digital at IMG. Lewis, you kicked ass in your interview. Are you now ready to get into some stoppage time?
Let's do it.
I will see if we can get you a goal here at the death. Number
All
one,
right.
the most memorable story you worked on during your time at BBC.
I don't think it's in as much as stories, I think about events. When I think back to my BBC career, what really stands out to me are major events like World Cups and Olympics. And I think when you work in our industry, you almost plot your career in those 2 and 4 year segments. Obviously, we have those annual events like the Super Bowl, but I think about the Beijing Olympics 2008 and then the London Summer Olympics in 2012. I think about World Cup 2006 when I was doing a certain specific type of job at the BBC, and then World Cup 2010 when I had moved into a different, more senior role. And I remember feeling all this pressure World Cup 2010, like I have to deliver this thing and it's all on me. And of course, as you get older in your career, you realize it's not all on you, actually. There's an entire team of people here who are incredibly good at what they do. But yeah, I'd say more than stories when I think back to them, my BBC days, it's more events.
That's awesome. I can't imagine how nerve-wracking and exciting it'd be to oversee an Olympics when it's a home Olympics and you're working for the BBC. Like, I mean, all on you guys.
Well, it was. I'd moved across to Twitter by the time that Olympics happened. So I kind of experienced those Olympics in 2012 through the lens of BBC Sport, where I was preparing a lot of it and then moved to Twitter just before the games, and then was very involved. Of course, Twitter in that era was such a big part of everything in sports. So London 2012 will always be very special to me.
So cool. Number two, we'll keep this one quick.
Yeah.
The sport besides football is the most popular in the UK, and also the sport you buy stock in for the future in Europe overall, assuming it's different.
Well, I would say F1. I mean, look, there are different
Okay.
answers to this question based on participation at grassroots level, based on broadcast revenues, based on commercial revenues, TV viewership, whatever it might be. the next biggest sport after football in the UK, given that that's going to be quite a tough question to get everyone to agree on how we would even answer that question. I would just highlight the phenomenal growth that F1 has had over the last few years, not just in the UK but globally. It just continues to go from strength to strength, and I think it's such an exciting sport. We're lucky enough to play a part with one of the teams which we love working for. It's a growth sport.
Yeah, definitely will be fascinating to see how it evolves when with the move to Apple as well, and what they do within the future.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, it's what Apple has already experienced with MLS, and it's going to be. I mean, the coming of the big streaming platforms into sports is a whole other podcast that we could do, Neil,
Oh
just
yeah.
on that. Not least because it refers back to the conversation we had before around knowing your audience digitally, and that sports industry is now dealing with broadcasters. Apple, Amazon, YouTube, Netflix, which started out as internet companies. These are digital first companies that will expect you as a sports rights holder to have a good understanding of your digital audiences. So there's a really interesting
Totally.
interplay there.
Yeah, the level of personalization and identification, they know who's watching. They know exactly who's watching. It's
Right.
fascinating.
100%. Yeah.
Perfect segue into question number three here. We'll keep this one quick as well. The broadcast innovation or approach that has just kind of most caught your eye, and why?
The broadcast innovation that has most caught my eye, I would
Whether
say,
it's, yeah.
would be creators becoming broadcasters, influencers
Yeah.
becoming broadcasters. I mean, what we've seen in Brazil, in France, in the UK, in the US, YouTubers and creators from other platforms acquiring sports rights or podcast shows acquiring sports rights. It's a fascinating, I would say, without a doubt, the most interesting innovation area in broadcast.
Definitely a good one. There's a long list of innovations as well. I mean, heck, we just I just watched the Monsters, Inc. Monday Night Football game the other night. So there's lots of interesting stuff happening
Huge.
in
Yeah.
broadcast.
Yeah.
Next
Yeah.
one for you, Lewis. Tell me, I love the work. I love being able to follow the work that Mailman Group does. As you mentioned, it's now under your purview at IMG. So what is the first step a team should take if they're initiating fan development efforts in China? Like, what is that recommendation?
Yeah, like you say, very proud of our team in China. The Mailman agency that we rebranded as part of IMG's digital team. So now one brand, IMG's digital team globally, which is the various digital groups we brought together. And Mailman was such a big is such a big part of that. I'm very proud of the people we've got in Shanghai and across APAC, I would say, actually, not just in China. But for China specifically, to answer your question, how would I think about that if I was a brand or a sports rights holder approaching China? I'd say a few things. One, start by listening, not assuming. So just because, this sort of quote unquote, China is a huge country, so therefore everyone there is a potential fan, and you come up with this sort of audience potential number, which is just a huge number. Actually, what you need to do is start by listening. Do some research, social listening, fan interviews, data analysis, understand what fans in China actually care about, rather than what you think they care about, and identify your entry point. I'd say, secondly, kind of finding your unique value in that market. What's your story? What would resonate? Is it a particular player, your team's legacy, your history of your sports team, or an aesthetic, whether it's an aesthetic of a player or your team that fits a certain community in China?
Yeah.
Thirdly, I would say then just make a start, but it can be pretty small, like hyper local, which might be a presence on Douyin or on Weibo or one of the other platforms in China. By the way, check out the IMG Digital Trends Report
Yeah,
for
great stuff there
a
on that red note.
platform power ranking list of Chinese platforms. And then use that to just start real-time feedback, like post and listen, and then grow it from there. But ultimately, Neil, the best answer to that question is to use the IMG digital team and our fleet of experts
Totally.
in Shanghai.
Great stuff. Next one for you. We're coming down the wire here. The most this I want I'm really excited about this one. First, just a quick hitter. The most impactful tweet or Twitter campaign from your time with Twitter, and then more to expound on what, if anything, will ever replace Twitter for that live event commentary and news breaking.
Because we're near the buzzer, I'll skip to the second part of that. And anyway, there were just so many tweets and great moments. Would anything replace her? Look, I think the world needs a town square. I think it needs a real-time news platform that the world can use, access, and listen. I have great hopes for X as it now is. I hope it succeeds. I'm unconvinced by most of the pretenders to its crown, and I'm no longer invested. I just hope that one of them comes through. It's an interesting moment in the evolution of that sector, not just that platform.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting point for sure. All right, we're gonna get you out. I have to ask my food question though. So tell me if I come out there and hang out in London or wherever in the UK, to tell me the best meal to get and where we're getting it. Give me a recipe.
Everyone who knows me well, who listens to this podcast, will find it so funny that you asked me that question, because I'm the worst person to ask. I don't know is the honest answer, Neil. We would go grab a pizza, and I would be quite happy with that, man. I'm not the person to ask for London's best restaurants. So, but it would be great to hang out with you. I don't drink alcohol, so I'd have a non-alcoholic
That's
beer with
cool, mate.
you
Me too.
and a slice of pizza, and that would be awesome.
Hey, pizza and great conversation. I will take it. Well, I'll
Right.
definitely fly out there. All right,
Right.
Lewis, you dominate and stoppage time. You scored a last minute goal. So tell us now your social media all-star follow. It doesn't have to be a social media person. It could be a newsletter, a podcast. It can be a Twitter follow, whatever it is. Just tell us who they are and why you recommend us to follow them.
Oh, man. And look, follow me, follow IMG, follow the organizations that we work for. I'm so proud of the relationships we have in the industry with the NFL, the NHL, Red Bull Racing, yes, Spurs, follow those guys. I will say what I said before, which is for me, IMG, we power the passion for sport, and it really matters to me because for me, what you push forward is the sports rights holders, the organizations that we get to work with on a daily basis. Follow me if you want, but mostly follow them.
I love it, man. The energy and passion comes through. People always tell me that I have passion for the space. I can tell you do too. And it's
Yeah.
a pleasure to be able to pick your brain today and have a great conversation.
Loved it, Neil. Thanks for inviting me on. Really appreciate your time.
Just tremendous stuff being able to speak with Lewis Wiltshire, Senior Vice President, Managing Director of Digital at IMG. What a privilege and a pleasure being. I followed his career for years, going back to Seven League and Twitter, and of course, all the tremendous stuff he's doing today with IMG. As he alluded to in our interview as well, if you haven't checked it out yet, I highly recommend checking out IMG's Digital Trends Report for 2025. There'll be a lot of good stuff to think about there. You heard a little bit of a preview and some in-depth conversation about some parts of that report within our interview, but there's lots more there to check out. So Google it. You can also look up Lewis or IMG on LinkedIn or myself. I posted about it as well. Lots of good stuff there. And we thank Lewis for coming on the podcast today and giving us a great way to close out 2025. But that'll do it for this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thanks again for listening. As always, I'm your host, Neil Horowitz. Find me on Twitter, NJ287, also on LinkedIn, where I post more content. The website where you can find everything is dsmsports.net. And this podcast is available on whichever podcast platform is your favorite. Until next time, this is Neil Horowitz signing off for the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast.